I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
97.1 FM Talk on demand audio.
Today is a Monday, actually. Thank you, Lou Graham. Although Sue tells me that Lou did not sound very good at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions over the weekend.
I'm sorry about that. I only heard a clip, and they had Kelly Clarkson in trying to do a duet with him and bring it up a little bit. It wasn't great.
I told Lou one time, and I feel this to this day, that he had one and still does, I hope, have one of the best voices in all of rock and roll.
Yeah.
I really, and you know, whatever happened with Foreigner, it's like, you know, these bands split apart because you haven't been able to see Lou Graham with Foreigner in I don't know how long. It's been a long time because it's been one of those rock and roll nightmares that occurs. And they've still been relatively decent up until a few years ago. Now there's no members. Like Mick Jones, they used to grab Mick.
Now we got nothing.
No, there's not any original members, but still a good piece of bumper music. And if you want to find out any of the songs that I play on the show, you can always go to the X formerly Twitter and find the list. I will post it at the end of the show. Stephen Malanga is going to join us in just a little bit from City Journal to talk about crime numbers, which we learned last week were all fake, even though most of us here in St. Louis knew that they were fake. So over the weekend, the two presidential candidates in many, many different states, here's the vice president.
Leaving nothing on the field. So I sit with you this afternoon after visiting two churches today, this Sunday morning. Yesterday I was in Michigan. Tomorrow I'll be in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And I'm leaving nothing on the field.
Yeah, that was today. She was in all three states, mainly because her polling numbers are terrible in all three states. Well, not terrible, but they're not looking real good right now. Meantime, Trump was making French fries.
And we're going to take from these ones first. It is first in, first out, the freshest ones.
And the best that the left has is to say, oh, that's a stage managed event. Of course, they said that so many times about the vice president. It becomes more and more clear, I think, after every day passes that he's really connecting with real voters. And she is not. Frank Mealy is with us, retired editor of the Daily Interlake in Montana. They have a good Senate race with John Tester, hopefully booting him out of the Senate up there in Montana. Frank, how are you this afternoon?
Well, from the non-battleground state of Montana, howdy.
Yeah, explain to me how John Tester has been the senator from your state for a while in the first place. Can you get your arms around that, or can you help us?
Well, it's largely good fortune with a lot of good politics. He had the good fortune to run originally, I think, in 2006 against Conrad Burns, who was caught up in a lobbyist scandal that even though he was very much a Montanan, as John Tester claims to be, and he was, a good old boy, he couldn't quite survive that. And then there was a little bit of Trump-like drama where the vote overnight swung to Tester, thanks to some late counting on Indian reservations. So there's been a little cloud there, but he's basically just playing a role as, a good old boy Montanan. And for whatever, Montana is not, apologies to all you Montanans listening, but we are not the smartest, most discerning voters on things like Senate races and especially Supreme Court races, where in Montana, the Supreme Court is elected. And even though, we are 70% conservative, we keep electing liberal Supreme Court justices. I'm waiting to see what happens here. And I know I'm 99% sure two liberals are going to be elected because they've got billions of dollars piled up and, character assassinating the two conservative candidates.
Interesting.
I'm getting sick of it.
Well, let's talk about the presidential race. And while many pundits might be a little shy in their predictions, Frank, you are not. You're kind of calling it right now. Here's what you said. Donald Trump will win, and he will win convincingly. Now, this is bad if you think that Trump's going to win, because I always get these things wrong. But I'm feeling more and more that you are right on this, that things are really trending in his direction. You can see kind of the panic in the Democrats and what she's doing, in all three of those states in one day, because they have to at this point.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely could be, upset by circumstances. It doesn't have to be rigged, but You know, there are lots of reasons why things are not going to turn out good for Trump. The main positive element is the fact that in the last two presidential races, the pollsters got it way wrong. Trump came 5 points or 6 points closer, or in one case in 2016, he won, even though he was supposed to lose to Hillary. And so if anything like that happens again, it'll be a landslide. I mean, if he can turn the polls around by 4 points, it's going to be, you know, mayhem. And as I say, liberal meltdown.
Well, there will be liberal meltdown. I mean, that will be. Did you hear Mark Halperin in his prediction on Tucker Carlson's
podcast?
That was pretty stark, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's predicting that there will be a massive increase in the need for psychotherapy in the country after Trump wins, and I can see that.
You know, Frank, we both kind of laugh about that, but there are so many people, I mean, chief among them, like the Joy Behars, that are so full of Trump derangement syndrome, they will lose their minds, which will be kind of fun for the rest of us, but they will lose their minds.
Absolutely. And we know that if for some reason he wins the presidency, and then for whatever reason, they lose the House and or the Senate, certainly the House first and then the Senate, he will be impeached, you know, and there's no doubt about it. Jamie Raskin's planning to try to, you know, have him declared an insurrectionist so he can't be sworn in. And, you know, it's going to be full out warfare. We've thought we had seen that before, but I certainly think when Trump gets any, and because he's promising to do all these really important, somewhat radical things compared to what's usually done, like deporting millions of people. If he actually goes through with his most, you know, consequential agenda items, the Democrats will completely, you know, go against him, and they'll do anything to stop him.
Well, I hope he does, and I hope we get to that moment. Indulge me, Frank, for a moment here, because I think this is interesting, too. And I heard this. I flipped over to CNN earlier this morning. This Harry Enten guy, he's kind of like their pollster dude. And he was talking about a lot of different numbers. But in this particular instance, the numbers with African-American men in support for Trump versus previous years.
And sometimes there's a trend line that I never noticed before and make me go, whoa. This is one of them, all right? This is the Democratic margin among black men under the age of 45 in presidential elections. You go back to November of 2012, what do you see? You see Obama by 81. Clinton only won him by 63. Then we're all the way down to Biden last time around by 53. A tremendous drop already. And then you take a look at the average of the most recent polls, and Kamala Harris is up by only 41 points.
41 points. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Let me just test something here this afternoon, Frank. Obama, he was African-American, wasn't he? He was black guy, first black president, if I remember history correctly. Trump, Hillary Clinton was white, wasn't she? Joe Biden is white. What isn't Kamala Harris? Doesn't she tell us she's black? Why could she have such terrible numbers with black men? What is the potential cause of that? Maybe because they see right through her?
I think that is it. I've been watching a lot of YouTube, and one of the reasons I'm pretty confident in my, you know, prediction for Trump's victory is because I watch a lot of black YouTube channels where they are so disgusted.
They don't like her.
But with the whole Democratic story of you owe us your vote, you know, and you've got Charlemagne the God over there saying, you know, we're going to stay on the plantation and we're going to do what we need to do to keep the Democrats in power. But there's a rebellion against that. And also I watch a lot of man in the street things on YouTube, and you know, it's totally, totally random, but when they go into like a party town, like nightlife, and they're talking to 20 to 30 year olds walking down the street, black, white, woman, man, they're all for Trump. And it is, you know, it is really, I think there is something going on that we better be prepared for, because I think that, you know, the polls, they call them suppression polls, where they try to convince the other side, you know, you better not bother to come out and vote because your guy's going to lose anyway. And, I think that's partly what's going on, but it's going to be difficult for the pollsters to, you know, come back at us with I think that's why it's tightening up now. They always, in the last few days or weeks, try to come back to reality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with Hillary Clinton, I think they had her up by 11 or something. And then suddenly, by the day before the election, she was up by 2 or 3. And then she lost, you know, the election. She won the popular vote. But, you know, I really don't know what's going to happen. But I like to pretend I do. And I think we're going to, I mean, it's got to be the most interesting election that we've had in our lifetimes.
Well, and it's by the way, like, if you are seeing a 1.5 point or even a 2 point national lead for Kamala Harris, that's not impossible. She could win the popular vote by 1.5, 2 points. But if she's only nationally, if she's only with a margin in the national polls of under 2 points, that's not good in the swing states. And they know that right now. You can kind of feel that this rollout, they're trying to put her on as many TV and radio interviews as they possibly can. That's the opposite of what they were doing a month ago.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, her rollout of media stuff was so disastrous with her. I can't think of anything I do differently than Joe Biden, you know, repeatedly saying that. It's just, and she's so phony, and Trump is so likable and just garrulous.
Well, we saw a lot of that over the weekend. And you just reminded me, I'm going to let you go, Frank, because I got some good audio from Kristen Welker and Josh Shapiro, which I want to, you kind of help me walk right into. But let's see what happens. We may have you back one more time before the election, but thank you so much.
All right.
Take care.
Take care.
So on the, we kind of references earlier on Josh Shapiro. From the very beginning, I think people were saying, why did you pick this Tim Walz guy? And then she's asked on the record, he was my guy. He was my guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know if they really, you know, and I didn't see Saturday Night Live over the weekend. Did you see?
Nope,
so I don't know if they do the whole bit with Jim Gaffigan. I'm not sure, coming off the, you know, the Al Smith dinner the other night. I'll have to check that out tonight. But Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, who's a Democrat, his state, you know, we keep saying it's all about Pennsylvania. Might not really be upon Pennsylvania if Wisconsin and Michigan are going to go to Trump. But lo and behold, every once in a while, and I don't know where it comes from, there's actual journalism and some questions that get asked. And Kristen Welker on the Meet the Press show yesterday did this with Josh Shapiro.
Has Vice President Harris done enough to distance herself from President Biden?
You know, Kristen, I think what is clear is this is a race, not between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, but between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. And on that, there are clear contrasts.
Can you name one key policy difference between Vice President Harris and President Biden? How would her administration look different?
Ooh.
Yeah. You know, I've been really encouraged by the amount of energy that Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris, has put into focusing on how she will cut taxes for small businesses. The focus on child care, tax credit expansion.
Those aren't necessarily differences, though. They're an expansion or a tweak to some extent to what's been done. Can you name one policy difference?
Well, listen, the contrast I am focused on, Kristen, is between her and Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. That's a no. He did not fare very well there. Now, this is fascinating. It really is. And I'm doing my best, Sue, because I ride this emotional roller coaster with presidential politics. And you know, and the audience knows, you get to late August, I was feeling like this was hers.
Hopeless.
And yeah, I didn't see. And a lot of people were trying to, you know, like Dwayne Patterson and others, try to, you know, get me off the ledge. Well, I'm off the ledge right now, but I want to be cautious because, as Frank even indicated, it's still a very, very close race. Tomorrow on the show, I'm going to get into this a little bit more. This is fascinating to me, and I'm going to read you something right now. I'm not going to tell you where it came from because I think that this is interesting when you hear where it came from. We'll investigate this a little bit more tomorrow with John Murawski. I met John a few years ago, and he has been great at exposing across the country and getting high-level universities, including MIT, my alma mater, Mizzou, and others, to pull back from this DEI nonsense, right?
Good.
So here's a story that was from the weekend that says this. And again, I'll tell you where it was from in a second. Leaders of the University of Michigan, one of America's most prestigious public universities, like to say that their commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion is inseparable from the pursuit of academic excellence. Most students must take at least one class addressing, quote, racial and ethnic intolerance and resulting inequality, unquote. Doctoral students in educational studies have to take a, quote, equity lab and a racial justice seminar. Computer science students are quizzed on microaggressions, Sue. Programs across the university are couched in the distinctive jargon that to the DEI practitioners reflects proven practices for making classrooms more inclusive, and to its critics reveals how deeply DEI is encoded with left-wing ideologies. So they go into how Michigan's largest division, it's not any other, it's not science, it's DEI, and we're going to get to some numbers here that are stunning, is about being anti-racist. And it dispenses handouts in identifying and addressing characteristics of white supremacy and culture, like worship of the written word. This is from the University of Michigan, right?
What?
We've talked about this. Every time we talk about DEI, I highlight that. That's worship of the written word. If you show up on time, you're a white supremacist. Because African-Americans, if you're African-American, you should be really offended by this, right? African-Americans don't show up on time, so we can't, as a white person, you can't say that. That makes them feel uncomfortable. If I'm a black guy or woman, I'm like, are you freaking kidding me?
How racist
is that, right? The engineering school promises a pervasive education around the issue of race, ethnicity, unconscious bias, and inclusion. At the art museum, captions for an exhibit of American and European art attest to histories of oppression, quote, even in works that may not have appeared to have any direct relation to these histories. The English department at Michigan has adopted a 245-word land acknowledgement describing its core subject as a language brought by colonizers to North America. Even the business school is committed to fighting, quote, all forms of oppression. Now, this story in the publication that I will name in a second talks about how 10 years ago they set this in motion, this DEI plan that was to enact far-reaching foundational change at every level in every unit, because you have to be anti-racist, right? So they have something called DEI 1.0, and they intentionally placed itself in the vanguard of a revolution then reshaping American higher education. That's what the story says. The story also says this. Interestingly enough, today that revolution is under withering attack, energized by backlash to Black Lives Matter and the right-wing campaign against critical race theory in public institutions. At least a dozen states have banned or limited DEI, thanks to John Murawski, by the way. After October 7th, as campuses across the country erupted with protests, critics accused DEI programs of fostering anti-Semitism, because they did. And in the fever of the campaign, Republican influencers and politicians have recast DEI as an all-purpose boogeyman, the root cause of defective airplanes, the collapse of a Baltimore bridge, and the near assassination of Donald Trump. Now, what I love about that line, and maybe now you know where this is from, is they never identify. You know what the boogeyman is on the other side? It's Project 2025.
Oh, that's right.
No one even knows what it is, even the people who claim to, you know, be talking about it. But this story also says this. Michigan hasn't joined the retreat that some of these other universities have. They've redoubled its efforts, testing the future of an embattled ideal. And this story goes into all these details about how they're now doing DEI 2.0. But the story also says this, Sue. According to a confidential report the reporter, obtained, a committee appointed by the provost and stocked with professors with DEI-related appointments urged the school this summer to continue using diversity statements in hiring and promotion, arguing that eliminating them would be seen as a capitulation to the winds of political.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Expediency. Now, here's the problem. This reporter says this. Over the months of reporting on this issue, I found a different kind of backlash building, one that emanated not from Washington or right-wing think tanks, but from inside the university's own dorms and faculty lounges.
There you go.
On Michigan's largely left-leaning campus, few of the people I met questioned the broad ideals of diversity or social justice. The most common attitude I encountered about DEI was a kind of wary disdain. DEI at Michigan is rooted in a struggle for racial integration that began more than a half century ago. But many black students today regard the school's expansive program as a well-meaning failure. The university now has a greater, listen to this, the university now has a greater proportion of Hispanic, Asian, and first-generation students and a more racially diverse staff. But in a state where 14% of residents are black, the school's black undergraduate enrollment has long hovered stubbornly at around 4% before ticking up to 5%. So in other words, 10 years ago, they had this big plan. You know what happened to the plan?
Mm-hmm.
It failed. It failed, and it's not working, and now they're confused about it, and there's backlash because the student and the staff says, look, this isn't working. You guys are stuffing all this stuff down our throats. I've said this when it comes to medical schools out there. You know, they take this big oath of office when they're doing the white robe ceremony, and I've said this. You can't tell me that those people that are about to become doctors that just went through 10 years of their life or whatever medical school is really want to sit and swear an oath to anti-racism. They just want to start getting paid in their profession that they've dedicated their lives to. But now this reporter from, want to take a guess?
Oh, go ahead.
This is the New York Times that's exposing this. But I love it because this guy has to come to terms with the fact that, you know, the survey that was released in 2022, students and faculty members reported a less positive campus climate than at the program's start and a less sense of belonging. Students were less likely to interact with people of a different race or religion or with different politics, the exact kind of engagement DEI programs in theory are meant to foster. Instead, the efforts have created a powerful conceptual framework for students and faculty grievances. And they go into long details here how people keep complaining about this. Now, what I don't have time to do is to go into the numbers here because Ethan's yelling at me because I got a guest coming up here. But we'll do this with John tomorrow because when you look at the number here, the number of people that have been hired for just DEI related purposes, it is astounding.
And they pay them a ton of money.
Look, this is a great story, and it's from the New York Times, and it rips to shreds this DEI nonsense, and it exposes how faculty members and people at the university don't like it either. But by the way, when I summed this up on Twitter earlier, here's what I said. I can consolidate it. For the love of God, ladies and gentlemen, do not send your kids to Michigan.
Get more at 971talk.com.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.